This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This episode of the Baby Tribe Podcast is proudly sponsored by HappyTummy.ie, the exclusive distributor of BioGaia probiotics for babies.
That's right. And as parents ourselves, we know how crucial it is to prioritize our children's health. BioGaia probiotics have been clinically proven to support digestive health and reduce the duration of crying in babies experiencing colic.
Absolutely, and HappyTummy.ie makes it incredibly convenient for parents to access these products.
Amazing! So for all your probiotic needs, head on over to HappyTummy.ie.
And Baby Tribe listeners can enjoy a 10% discount on all products at HappyTummy.ie with the code BABYTRIBE10. Okay, let's get on with the episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Baby Tribe Podcast. We're delighted that you're still here with us. Katie, how are you doing?
I am good, Afif. Pretty much prepping now for Easter. I can't believe it's only around the corner and I've got my kids at home for 2 whole weeks while we're trying to manage work.
I know, and we just got over midterm and we have another 2 weeks off to try and entertain our children.
I know. I think every parent around the country is probably saying the same. How are we going to manage? You don't probably have to do camps or anything now, do you?
No, we have no camps. We're very bad parents. My daughter's nearly 16. My son is 13. They sort of manage themselves in front of screens.
Oh,
we're going to talk about screens today again. But we're also going to talk about play.
Yeah.
And what kind of things do your kids do?
So actually, we're big into the camps. Well, so the older Luke won't do it, but the three youngers, or at least the youngest two, will do it. We've actually got them booked in, ready to go for play ball and a few things to keep them occupied. But they love actually getting out of the house and playing.
Yeah, my main concern is how am I going to entertain the dog for 2 weeks? I should have booked in Buddy into a
dog camp. Do they even have doggy camps?
They actually do.
Get away.
They actually do. But you know what? They're actually booked out months in advance.
What?
Yeah, absolutely.
I cannot believe
that. Yeah, there's a big one. There's a big one where there's a massive playground with slides and rides and everything for dogs. It's ridiculous.
And it costs a fortune.
I never looked into the price because they're always booked out.
Because camps can be really pricey for kids. But on the other hand, they're not sitting in front of a screen and they're out and active. Do you know, for the younger ones, it's really important.
And that's a key thing for our conversation today, isn't that right?
Yes. So today we are actually going to talk all about play and child development and the benefits and why it's so important in a child's life. So to start this segment, guys, we have none other than Afif, who is going to give us a little bit of his nerdy segment, all about play.
I'm just giving the audience what they want. People keep asking for the nerdy segments and I'm here to deliver.
Guys, I'll keep it basic and Afif is going to give us the nerdy bit that actually, you know, makes it. I just simplify it.
Not at all. Before we actually come on to actually do the episode, we always plan. And Katie always says, you do the boring bit, I'll do the fun bit. And
that is so true. Yeah. So true.
So Katie, let's pause for a moment to remind our listeners that Baby Tribe is now part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, and we are now in a position to offer our listeners bonus content via Head Stuff Plus.
That's right, Afif. Our spin-off series, Keeping Up with the Kafashians, hosted by you and your lovely wife, Anne Doherty, treats our listeners to the fabulous husband and wife discussions and expansion of points raised here on the Baby Tribe, and some science as well.
So please subscribe for as little as €5 per month and make sure to select Baby Tribe and Keeping Up with the Kafashians as your podcast to support. Subscribing will give you access to all the bonus content on Head Stuff Plus. And guys, Katie's weekly appearance fees are getting a bit much for me, so we'd really value your support.
I wish everyone. Afif's skincare routine is ridiculous. You should see the potions and lotions he uses every single day.
Listen, it takes a lot to look this good. Thank you to everyone who have subscribed so far. And if you haven't subscribed yet, why the hell not? So I want to talk about a study that looked at the association between screen time and physical activity and its association with executive function in a group of toddlers from the US at around 2 years of age. So why is this important? Well, I think it is important because we know that study after study after study showing a negative association between exposure to screens and outcomes in terms of things like executive function. And people might ask what executive function is. And I think it's important to spend a couple of minutes describing what it is, because a lot of the play techniques and play styles that Katie's going to describe are actually there to help infants, toddlers, and children develop their executive functioning skills. So what is that? Well, Executive functioning is almost like your command center of the brain. It's the collection of mental skills that can help us get things done. So these skills are controlled by an area of the brain called the frontal lobe, which sits at the front of our head. The components of executive functioning fall under three main headings, and I'm sure, Katie, you will relate to those three, and you will see how, unfortunately, a lot of people can miss one or two of those things, especially husbands, and I'll get to that in a second. So the first one is working memory. So that's like almost the brain's sticky note, where it helps us hold on and work with information, allowing us to remember instructions, solve problems, and keep track of ongoing tasks. So I'm sure you can relate, when you have a busy household and you have a million things to do, you'll need to be able to maybe categorize those functions into importance in order for you to be able to get them done one after the other. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. It's a mother's world.
Mother's world. But if you actually bring it down to a child, imagine that you've asked your maybe 4 or 5 year old, go get your shoes and put them on. And they have to go from the living room into the hallway and pick up their shoes. So that sort of instruction is in their brain and they have to be able to execute it. So they walk over and they need to be able to remember, okay, I'm walking over to get my shoes. Let's say then something happens along the way. This is where number two of the components of executive functioning comes into place, which is called cognitive flexibility or flexible thinking. This is the skill, like being a sort of almost a mental acrobat. It allows you to think about something in more than one way, like understanding that a banana is both a fruit and sometimes a banana is yellow, or being able to adapt to unexpected situation. Let's say, for example, the child that you've asked to fetch the shoes, they couldn't find the shoes at the front hall. You know, if they weren't able to executively think, they will terminate the task and come back and say, I couldn't find them. Whereas a child that has cognitive flexibility or flexible thinking might think, okay, they're not in the front hall. They might be at the back door. I'm going to go check there.
So don't worry now. Most parents go, my kids do that all the time.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like multitasking. And I always get blamed for not being able to multitask. And I'm sure a lot of dads that might be listening say, I get blamed for my inability to multitask, and my wife or my partner is much more able at multitasking than me. So, you know, these are all components of executive functioning. The third one, which is one which I think a lot of people are lacking, unfortunately, is inhibitory control or self-control. So this is like having almost an internal traffic light, and it's what we refer to as our filter. You know how we sometimes think that a lot of people do not have a filter? And if you ever frequent X or Twitter, you'll see how a lot of people lack inhibitory control and lack self-control when they're responding to things right, left and center. So this helps us stop and think before acting, resisting temptations, staying focused. So for children, it's actually quite important, because this means waiting for their turn in a game or resisting the urge to shout an answer in the class when it's not their turn to do so. And it also can have other potential implications, like stopping eating when you are full and not continuing to eat because what you're eating is nice and sugary and sweet. So it has a lot of implications down the line. So putting all of these things together, why are these skills important? Well, they are because they're crucial for learning, social interaction, emotional well-being, and they help children follow directions and complete tasks, stay focused and resist distractions, juggle multiple tasks, control impulses and emotions, and plan and organize activities and future tasks. So they really are the foundation of being able to function in society down the line. And play is a very, very important component in helping you adapt and develop those executive functioning skills. So what the study that I originally mentioned showed is that they looked at the adherence to various guidelines in various facets of how you raise your child. And they've divided it into four different things: physical activity, screen time, having 5 servings of fruit and vegetables, and eating a lot of sugary drinks. So I'm going to quiz you now, Katie, and I'm going to ask you to guess, when they asked parents whether they adhere to the recommended guidelines of physical activity in children, how many do you think in percentage have adhered to the physical activity component?
Oh, I'd say it's reduced hugely in the last probably 10 to 20 years. 60%?
Actually, it's a bit higher than that. It's 75%, which I was pleasantly surprised
Not too bad.
That a lot of kids at 24 months of age still do a lot of physical activity. What about screen time? How many adhere to the 1 hour of screen time a day in percentage?
Definitely not. 30%.
It's actually 50%. So
wow. Okay.
I mean, I'd say maybe...
That's pretty good.
Maybe a lot of people are...
I hate to say it, but I'd say those kids are the ones in creche.
Yeah.
And then when they come home, they have their hour when they get home.
Exactly.
Before bedtime.
This is the stark one. Fruit and vegetable servings. How many adhere to the recommended?
Oh, I'd say that's probably good. At the age of two?
This is in the US now.
Oh, in the US. Okay, I take it back. 50%.
4%.
Oh, wow, that's shocking. I would love to see a study in Ireland because I think it would be higher. For the age group of two, I'd say people are, I would think at least.
So 95% of 24-month-old children do not get enough fruit and vegetables.
Okay, that's scary.
And then what about adhering to sugary drinks? Juices, as in not consuming
the States,
sugary drinks.
I'd say 4 or 5%.
It's actually 70%.
So 70?
Yeah.
So I'd question that.
Yeah, but I mean that's what the study showed. But anyway, what they have found, the key findings of the study, is that less screen time is linked with better executive function in toddlers.
Yeah.
Okay, and more physical activity is also associated with better executive function. Interestingly, the dietary adherence to dietary guidelines showed no significant executive function impact that early on. So it just really highlights the potential detrimental effects of prolonged screen time in those kids.
Yeah.
And the importance of play and physical activity.
We are taking a quick pause to cross-promote another amazing podcast from the Head Stuff Network. Afif, who are we showcasing this week?
Ah, Katie, this is a special one and one of my favorite newly launched podcasts out there. Deirdre O'Kane and Emma Doran have teamed up to launch a new podcast called Keep It Tight, where they discuss what's delighted them, what's bewildered them, what's enraged them, and everything in between. No topic is out of bounds, from the highest brow to the lowest pelvic floor. Let's have a quick listen.
So Gwyneth Paltrow's a pain in the hole. Is that agreed?
I think that's the national consensus on Gwyneth, that she's a melt, she's a pain in the hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, if you're listening in who else is a pain in the hole, we have a list.
Oh, we have a list and it's extensive and it's growing.
Pains in the hole and the ticks. We have a list of ticks.
Yeah. And we'll get into it. And if you don't agree with us, that means that you could be in the list. So you might as well listen.
Yeah. To make sure you're not on the list of ticks.
Yeah.
Or pains in the hole. Somebody used to call me Deirdre O'Pain in the hole.
But you're definitely not a pain in the hole.
I'm not. God, no. Okay. But I am doing a podcast called Keep It Tight with Emma Dorn.
We're here, myself, and the queen of comedy, Deirdre O'Kane. We're keeping it tight every week on a Wednesday. Get involved or you'll be on the list.
Yeah, you tick.
When Katie starts going through everything to do with play, you might begin to see how different play techniques, different play activities may actually influence and develop the different facets of executive functioning that I'm talking about. So take it away, Katie.
So I suppose, you know what, to start with, I think most of us don't give enough credit to play. And I think when we look at it, kids are so amazing in that they can create play anywhere, outdoors, indoors, in all environments. And even when you think of different environments, poverty, war-torn zones, you can still see, even on videos at the moment, of kids going out and kicking a ball and playing. They can create games and fun anywhere and everywhere. And I think we really have to allow them time to do that. And that's why I think that study is really good and really appropriate, in that it shows that when we have kids sitting in front of a screen time, they can become so focused that they actually don't engage with play activities that they should. It's really important. I suppose play is a way that children kind of make sense of the world. It engages them, it motivates them, it challenges them. And children are born with like an innate drive to kind of learn. They're smart, they're incredible, intelligent little people. And if we put them in the right places that they can learn and thrive, they will be able to demonstrate all the, I suppose, developments that we look at, the physical, the intellectual, social, emotional, that Afif has kind of already touched on. It is really important that when we look at socially how kids engage in games through play, they learn how to make friends, they learn how to take their turns, and so much more. So it's really like a problem solving. They learn cognitively in so many ways. So we're going to talk a little bit on the development, physical development in play, because this is one of the areas, did you say 70% actually still adhered to in the study?
Yes.
By the age of two. That's pretty good. I suppose when we look at the different age categories, when we look at kind of 0 to 1, we know that most babies, predominantly, they feed and sleep in the first year of life. We know that. But the activities that we can look at, when we look at kind of play activities for the 0 to 3 month olds, we're looking at a bit of tummy time, essentially, between their sleeps and everything else, activities. What we're looking at is tummy time. You start very small, 1 to 2 minutes starting off on their tummy and then roll them back onto their back on an activity mat or just a simple blanket on the floor with a few toys around. What we're looking at is then by the time they kind of hit the 3 month mark, about 5 to 10 minutes, 3 times a day of tummy time. Now that can be split up even more if your baby doesn't tolerate it well. It doesn't need to be on floor time. It can be on other places as well, on a mother's knees or a parent's knees, on a couch or even on your yoga ball.
And that's a key thing that parents often come to me and say, look, I've got a rabbit 5-year-old and another rabbit 3-year-old that I can't put my child on the ground. They'll trample all over him or her. So can I do tummy time anyway else?
So there's loads of ways of doing tummy time. It doesn't need to be on the floor, but I suppose as time goes on, the floor is the child's environment for learning and play. So with, I suppose, when you can manage it and you're sitting down around them, that if you can corner them off, great. Otherwise, though, when they're really small, again, babies that are carried in slings end up with very good core control and head control as well. That can be kind of an alternative form of tummy time. Give them time to kick, let the legs loose, take off the nappies and give them a little bit of time on the floor. Those mobility or the activity centres where the baby's on the flat and on their mat on their back and having their little toys dangling, that encourages them to reach and grasp. We'd expect by about 3 months that they can hold a rattle. So holding something in their hand, they will drop it, but they'll start making noises. And this is very interactive. So with the 3 to 6 months old, we're still on the same. It's all about interaction. When we even look at our social interaction, that we're doing singing and playing games and even using your hands to do clap hands, pat a cake, these kind of activities, head, shoulders, knees and toes. And I know people are going, what is she talking about? That's really for the toddler stage. But actually what we're just doing is guiding their little hands and doing the same activities, placing their toys a little bit out of reach. So we're making them move a little bit more. And we're trying to encourage that when they are on their backs on the floor, that we're trying to encourage them to roll. So moving the toys a little bit further away will lead to them rolling and leaning over. And we'd start seeing maybe towards the 6 month old, some babies could be sitting independently at this stage, but just making sure that they're still getting some floor time as well.
As you've alluded to very brilliantly, at this stage, play is all about exploring your senses and developing your basic motor skills. And that lays down the groundwork for later executive function learning. So you're not expecting much from babies up until that stage, but really what they're working on now is developing their motor skills, their other sensory skills, so that they can learn more down the line.
Exactly. And then I suppose if we move on to 6 to 9 months old, this is where we're encouraging them to kind of go from the sitting, and they should be able to kind of sit independently. And you may even notice that they can go from lying to sitting very easily. Again, we're going to do a bit of peekaboo games. And I actually always love this part where, you know, kids think if their eyes are covered, they can't see, you can't see them. And I think it's one of the nicest parts when you see a little kid and they get their blankie and put it up and they start playing peekaboo with you. And it's a really good, both socially and physical game to do with them. Playing music, holding, you know, rocking and even getting them banging on things can be really effective. And I suppose we're really talking about floor time. So now we should start seeing them rolling, or even that they're making the kind of army crawl towards crawling if they haven't reached that phase. Some kids will go straight up onto their knees from the rolling position when they're on their tummies, but some will actually start with the army crawl and then engage into a full crawling position. Swimming is a really good activity. Loads of babies love the water.
And on swimming, a lot of parents ask me if they can bring their 3-month-old for a swim. And often what we really say is the main thing to watch out for is the temperature of the water. When they're that young, it's really hard for them to control and keep their body temperature. So always preferably bring them to a warmed pool rather than a sort of unwarmed and cold pool. And remember last season, we spoke about how stranger anxiety usually develops in around 9 months of age. But throughout COVID, what I noticed is that babies that are 5-6 months old were actually displaying signs and symptoms of stranger anxiety much, much earlier. And we think it's because they did not really get a lot of interaction with other individuals other than their parents. I'm actually seeing now that that is almost completely gone. So they're not displaying stranger anxiety at 6 months. It's kind of come back to 9 months of age. So it just shows you the adaptability of babies and the influence of the environment on all of those developmental milestones that you talk about.
That's so true, Afif. And just with regards to the swimming, a lot of those swim clubs that you see being offered now, they're all in much warmer, kind of 30 degree plus. So it's not the freezing cold swimming pools that we're used to. But also just remember, if you are going and you're a bit unsure of temperature, you can purchase those, their core body kind of warmers, especially for the 0 to 3 months. And I'd probably recommend, even if you're going into the warmer pools, that they should be using them to prevent the drop in body temperature. Okay, so next on to 9 to 12 months old. I do love this stage. This is where they're starting to get really active. This is where a really good game is if you have a baby sitting and their legs are slightly apart, getting a nice soft bowl and just ball and rolling it up and back to them. And they will do this for nonstop for ages and ages and ages. They love picking up things, pouring things out. So even you'll see when you're in the weaning stage, they love to pour out their water cups and involve play with that. If you're sitting outside and it's a lovely summer's day, it's really good if they have a little basin and you give them cups, they'll just keep pouring the water in and out of the cups, obviously keeping them, observing them all the time for safety. And then I suppose when you look at this age group, a lot of the physical activity will come from, are they moving yet? Are they crawling? Are they cruising? Are they going up and down? So you'll see babies that will start pulling themselves up on the side of furniture and they'll go up and down. I know we would nearly struggle trying to get up and down from our bums on standing, but it's amazing to see how little tots can do it so easily. And then I suppose any of the games with regards to bouncing on your knee, any of those, again, pat a cake, any of the clapping, shoulders, knees and toes, any of the singing is really good. And all this, although it's all physical, we're also bringing in the social element and also verbal as well. So when we're doing singing, we're bringing along their verbal skills. We're interacting with them all the time. So although we're kind of looking at the physical side, there's so many other benefits when we're doing these games as well.
What are your views on walkers and bouncers?
Absolutely. Well, walkers, 100% not. As public health nurses, we get a lot of information or a lot of queries on them. Walkers, we do see leads to tippy toe walking, and also it's a huge safety hazard. So it gives the baby a kind of higher reach to things where they shouldn't be. And also we see so many as peds nurses coming in with head injuries, falling down steps, and they can go really quick. When you think you're in total control, it's a huge safety hazard.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of them at all. Anyway, what about 1 to 3 years? That's when the real fun begins.
This is where you nearly wish they were still sitting in the corner. This is where you go out for dinner, you're like, why? Yeah. Why did we go there?
Yeah.
It's still so, like, I suppose 1 to 3 years is where we're still seeing them. We're seeing them really take off now with the physical activities. We're kind of talking that they should be active for at least 3 hours every day under 6-year-olds. I don't think many people know that. And that's quite physical activities, as in if they're running around the place, and that can be in between naps. It is important that we try to limit, obviously, screen time, and we work around sleep, and naps is one of the biggest things. So when we're talking about the 1 to 3-year-olds, what do they particularly like? So the 12 to 18 months, they're kind of a bit smaller. So we're still looking at encouraging their walking skills. So this could be that they may be walking already, they may not, but a really good way is, if we're encouraging, is that if one of the parents or maybe siblings holding them on one side and you're sitting on the others with your arms open and getting them to toddle over to you and take their first steps, and everyone gasps in excitement, and it's a lovely, lovely first milestone to reach.
That reminded me of a very sad thing where my wife was doing a 24-hour shift and
she missed
my son's first steps, where he literally just got up and started walking, took 2 or 3 steps and then fell back on his arse. And luckily I was filming him, so I captured it and was able to send it straight away to her.
Oh, that's nice. At least yeah. You got to, well, even sadder, myself and Jim were gone on our honeymoon and Luke took off walking at 11 months. My sister had to pretend he didn't until we got back.
Oh,
no,
brilliant.
He was walking.
Oh, brilliant. That's great.
But at least you captured it. I'm proud of you, Afif.
Yeah.
So again, 12 to 18 months, you're doing pretty much the same things. It's letting them have free reign of the environment. And oftentimes, I think you'll agree, if we have all these toys and all these great building stacking blocks, the rings that go over the, what do you call that thing?
Pegs?
Yes, kind of peg thing. Yeah. Like, they're all brilliant and we love them, but you'll often find a kid will have probably more fun in emptying out a shelf and climbing into it, or an empty cardboard box. So it's about letting them create their own play within their own environment. So having some toys, but remember, we do not need to spend huge amounts of money on toys. It's all about the environment that they get to play within.
Yeah, and that's a clear way of describing how there's structured play and unstructured play.
Yeah.
And kids really benefit from unstructured play because these are crucial times for toddlers to begin focusing on exploration, learning to control movements, and also begin to problem solve. You know, how do I get to that shelf? How do I get those toys out of the box? How do I get the little circle into the peg and things like that? So all of these things are crucial components of developing your executive functioning down the line.
Yeah. And like even between the 12 months to 2 years, you know, the they're not walkers, but you know, the way they're like an activity center that they walk with, they can be very good for getting them off walking, or even the old style kind of little cars that they sit on, they push themselves along. They're all really good ways if you kind of want to find something to help them or aid them rather than a walker or any of these kind of bouncers. The 2 to 3 years, we can kind of bring in a bit more structured play, but also allowing them to have free play. And we'll look at any creches or play schools. It's all about free play, to let them in kind of, we go with them with regards to what they like to do. So that might be bringing in balls, starting to learn to kick a ball. So we'd expect by the age of three that a child could kick a ball, but obviously only if they've done it before. Catching and throwing, it's quite a complicated task, but it's more if we can get them to start throwing the ball and we try to catch it. We encouraging them with jobs around the house. Kids love to be involved, especially if there's a new sibling on the way, or if they've got a younger sibling, asking them to be involved and helping them, giving them a little cloth and getting them to clean around the place. Although we don't think of it as play, it's actually like giving them possibly a 1 to 2 command task. So by you saying, go get your runners and put them on, that's a 2 kind of command task. And we'd expect by the age of kind of 3 to 4 that children can follow 2-part demands, commands.
And that's a very key point that you bring up, because a lot of parents will say, I don't have time to spend 3 or 4 hours engaging and playing with my child. And what a lot of people actually don't realize is, by them just being with you, that actually sometimes counts as structured and unstructured play. And also involving them in the mundane tasks that you're doing, to them, it's a lot of fun. Because like you said, hand them a towel and say, go clean that door. You know, even if they spend half an hour doing it, they may slow you down a little bit doing it, but that's all part of, you've almost killed 2 birds with 1 stone. You've done the cleaning and you've engaged with your child.
Child labor.
Exactly, child labor. I remember Fazil did something very, very bold when he was 3, and we were struggling on how to punish him because he would just never learn. And I said, fine, you're coming with me and you're cleaning the bedroom. And I handed him a little cloth and I said, you go clean all the drawers. And he went quiet for about half an hour. And then he came to me and he said, you know, Dad, this doesn't feel like a punishment at all. I'm really enjoying myself. Great.
Ruin that.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, like, so those little activities, we don't have to be involved in every part of our child's play. Like, let's be really clear. And I think parents sometimes, and I think, oh, now even more than ever, I think parents feel obliged, or they're not being a good parent if we don't sit with our parents or our children 24 hours a day. I love nothing more than to see a kid walk in and just sit down and play with their own toys. Some kids are better than others, I will definitely say, of making their own fun up. But it's really important to let them be creative. Really good games, copy kind of cat activities, like so skipping, jumping, playing hop, tippy toes, chasing games. They love playing tag. That's like, even Jack now, who's 5, I'd say he's been playing it since he's about 2 with the others. Hide and seek is a great one. And that hide and seek, even if we look back on the 9 to 12 months, can work really well with babies who have, you know, they're very attached and they're really struggling with separation anxiety. That can be a really good one to play. So, you know, mom kind of just ducks under her couch, but she comes back. So it's reassuring the child all the time. But 2 to 3 year olds as well, I think we've gotten away from the tricycles. But tricycles are amazing for development. We're kind of on scooters now, where they're able to go on a scooter. And in fairness, if they can do a scooter and push along with one leg, their coordination is pretty good. Tricycles can be really, really good for encouraging using the 2 feet together, and even jumping skills, things like that. Intellectual development, I think you've spoken quite a bit about this anyway, Afif. But it's, I suppose, play really does help using their imagination and letting them do free play, counting. So the counting games, kids learn nearly before they even start preschool. If they've been playing in games 1, 2, 3, ready or not, here I come, doing that kind of way. And then I suppose when we're looking at all the games, jigsaws are absolutely amazing. Think really small, and they don't need to be hugely complicated, but very small. you know, anywhere between 6 to 8 pieces for the smaller kids, shapes, trying to put shapes into the boxes. These are all really old style games that are kind of nearly lost now, but they're really important for kind of intellectual development. And then social, I think social development is part of every element of play. So it's where kids are building relationships, taking turns, fighting over the rules, things like that. So they find their place, they build relationships, they understand where they fit in their society, they understand how they will lead or be the leader or be the person who follows the leader. So social development is really important. And we can see kids' personalities coming out very strong. I can definitely say for my fourth, he doesn't take losing at all well. And we found out, I think it was his third sports day.
Yeah.
And like, he's really placid. And they said, Katie, he had a breakdown. I went, what? I couldn't believe it when I went to class. I said, yeah, I was really upset. It took us a while to calm down. I said, why? He didn't win the race. He's so competitive. Well, by his nature.
He didn't lick it off the floor, Katie.
No, I'd say in fairness, I'm quite competitive. And so is Jim, in fairness. I think we're both quite competitive. And it kills us because I would say my daughter, Lily, who is the most placid child we've ever, is so not competitive at all. Yeah. That you'd be like, you'd be watching her playing camogie and be like, just go in and get it. And she'd just like tip along. She's like, oh, hi, it was a great game. I'm like, really? Yeah. So it just shows different personalities. He's definitely our very competitive one. So I suppose to kind of end it up, how can you help your child through play, develop child development through play? And that is, I suppose, engage with their child, with your child's interests. Everyone will have their own style and it's important that you just engage with them and sit down and let them be. Copy how they play. Sometimes let them take the lead and you be there with them. As they get older, you know, play doctors and you be the sick person. You know, if they want to play house, play house. And that's building up social skills as well. Talk about what they're doing. For example, if they're pushing a cart, then you say, oh, well done, you're pushing the cart. So you're bringing in the verbal skills as well. Be slow and repeat. And remember, your child's brain needs time to learn new skills. Listen, let them take the lead and show you what their interests are and you lead the way.
Did you see how I used the Irish terms? Like, he didn't lick it off the floor. Like, there's no tomorrow. I'm so well used to them now.
You have changed. Your mother would probably give out to you for that now.
I remember the first time I heard a parent tell me that about their child. I was in, I was just starting out in clinical practice and I remember doing my rotation. This was, I don't know, in the late 90s and I've never heard that term before. And I was taking a history from a mother and the child did something funny and I commented on it. And then she looks at the dad and she says, well, he didn't lick it off the floor. And I went, well, I hope he licks nothing off the floor. That is disgusting. You know, and yeah, people forget that, you know, all of these phrases that
are not worldwide.
They're very Irish, but it's great when you end up understanding what they are. They're fantastic.
So you're pretty Irish now anyway at this stage.
Well, I've been here nearly 30 years. So yeah,
you're probably longer here than you were at home.
Oh, definitely. I came here when I was 17. I'm 40. Yeah. I'm 46 now. So yeah, definitely. So we have an amazing guest. I'm really delighted that I was finally able to pin down this person.
I'm so excited.
Audrey Hamilton is an amazing Irish abstract artist. I'm sure many of you have seen her work and I'm sure many of you have maybe purchased some of her pieces as well. And she's also an amazing fashion designer and her creativeness is just astounding. We have an amazing conversation coming up. She was actually one of my inspirations to start doing my own art business and put it out there. So I'm really, really excited to share this interview with you. Audrey, thank you so much for coming on the Baby Tribe podcast. I've been trying to get you on here forever. We're really, really excited. Can you please, to start off, tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey as an artist and a fashion designer and what led you to where you are today?
What an intro. Thank you, Afif. I'm delighted to be here at the Baby Tribe. What led me to becoming an artist and a fashion designer? Well, to cut a very long story short, I was an actor in Ireland, predominantly in theatre. So I'd say about 10 years of my late teens to late 20s, that's all I did. That's all I wanted to do. It was my life. I was born and bred to be in entertainment, let's say. Myself and my now husband, then boyfriend, Jack, we decided to move to Los Angeles to give it a go over there in the world of film. He is a creative producer and he's also was an actor back in the day. So we were like, okay, let's do it. Let's pack our bags. What have we got to lose? 3 years we were there. we didn't love it, but we were really trying, you know, got all the auditions, got a manager. I was actually booking small jobs, but they say, you know, you start off, you get commercials, you get some independent movies, short films, independent feature films, and I was getting roles and little bits. And then I got this audition for a Netflix TV show. It was Paramount and ABC. So they were like, there was different production companies that can be under the one roof, right? So these names obviously jumped out and I was like, oh my gosh, this is huge. My manager was like, this is amazing. It's a Marvel TV show for Netflix. So it was like kind of, you know, Marvel-esque. So not cartoon, but like superhero.
Oh, amazing. Kind of vibe. We're huge Marvel fans in this house.
Well, there you go. It was actually a show called The Runaways, which only got one season, which I'm glad that it did because I'll tell you what happened. Not that I'm bitter or anything. But basically, I booked the job. I was so excited. My manager was like, this is a door now that's going to open your career, hopefully, in Los Angeles. Hollywood, the bubble. So I was so excited. I showed up to set. I had my own trailer. I was WhatsApping my family WhatsApp group with a picture of me beside my name on a trailer. I'd never had that before. And my parents and my family were like, are so supportive of everything that I do. But they were like, oh my gosh, this is insane. It's so exciting. And I had to send all the paperwork up to production, which is a thing that you have to do over there. You have to go through visas, passports, yada, 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 in any audition and any job that you book. Doesn't have to even be in entertainment, anything. It's called your paperwork. So that was sent up and I went into hair and makeup in the trailer beside me. And then I came back in and I was sitting in my trailer reading my script. I was in hair and makeup. My costume was on. And next thing, a little knock, a very sheepish knock on the door. And I opened the door and it was the lovely AD, the assistant director. And she was like, can I come in? And I was like, yeah, of course. And she was like, I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to release you from set.
Oh my God.
Was what she said first. And I was like, what? What have I done? I was like, oh my God, did I say something to offend someone? I was like, what did I do? This Irish girl sitting in the makeup chair, did I curse too many times? Like, what did I say? And she was like, basically, it's not your fault. It's casting that made an uh-oh. They basically cast an O-1 visa holder and production were not accepting visa holders because it was paperwork that they didn't want to have to deal with. So I was pretty much fired on the spot. I left the set. I stayed for about 2 hours back and forth on the phone to my lawyer trying, like the makeup girls, like everyone was like, is there nothing you can do? Like they knew from somebody that had been in LA for 2.5 years that this was like such an important job to get. It wasn't a big role. It wasn't a huge, big movie star thing, but it was the door you needed to get open to work with like good production companies. Anyway, that dream was cut and I literally went home back to our little house in LA and my husband was like, okay, look, it's fine. Just go and find something else to do while you're here. I was like, no, I'm so done with LA. This has left such a bad taste in my mouth. Like, let's go home. Luckily, he could work from anywhere, so it wasn't a huge big deal to pack up and leave. But he was like, okay, well look, I have to finish this job I'm doing at the moment. Why don't you just do something creative? Don't let your mind wander. Don't want to end up getting depressed. I was in such a rut of, I'm now, how old was I? I was 29, 30. I think I was just turned 30. I was like, I'm 30-year-old, unemployed, don't now know what I want to do. I really took that moment as acting is done. Like you spend so much money and so much time trying to get a visa to get over.
So you had the correct visa. They just didn't want to deal with the paperwork.
No. So what they don't tell you when you try and get a visa is many of the big production houses don't accept O-1 visas. What they do accept is, listen up, listeners, to anybody that's going for a visa in the States in the entertainment world, a lot of them only accept umbrella O-1 visas, right? So an umbrella O-1 visa is when a production company, let's say like the likes of maybe Saoirse Ronan back in the day, she would have been booked by, let's say, Warner Brothers, and she would have been given an umbrella visa for the time that she's filming under the roof of Warner Brothers. Whereas all of us, when we try and go over to somewhere like America and we get our O-1 visa, we can go and audition for anything. But they don't tell you when you're paying for, I think it's $7,000 back then.
Oh, wow.
9 months of writing what was like a thesis about yourself and why you should be able to go over and act in America. They don't tell you that half the production companies don't even accept them.
Wow.
So it's all a moneymaker at the end of the day for them. Well, and we were the naive.
There's the first tip of the day here for anybody.
Don't go to America.
Exactly, yeah.
But that led to painting.
And have you painted beforehand?
Well, I grew up in a very creative household by my mom and dad. My dad is very creative. My mom is very creative. And we just, it was something we did. It wasn't even something we had to think about. It was just always part of our livelihood of at home. Everything was so creative, whether it was singing, dancing, drawing, anything like that. I absolutely loved. So I always painted, but I never, ever thought of it as a career. Never. And so because my husband was so used to me doodling or like painting something for the house for decor or like finding a piece of wood out the back and putting a quote on it to hang in the whatever. He was like, he bought me some canvas and some paints and he was like, just go to town, have a bit of fun. We'll go home in a couple of months. And that's it. I popped Posh Pig and his and her giraffe. And they were the first pieces of this.
And at that stage, have you thought about selling them or commercializing
them? God,
no.
No. Oh, okay. My God, no. I had no idea about that. I just popped them up on Facebook. I didn't have like an Instagram either.
Okay. So, and then what prompted you to take it further? Did you get a lot of good feedback?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So I posted it on Facebook. I was like, started something fun here in LA. What do you guys think or whatever? Like, just as I actually almost did it as a joke because I was like, it's a pig with pearls.
Yeah.
It's Posh Pig or whatever. Like, and I was messing. And the response was insane. I don't think I'd ever post a picture of myself or anything on my Facebook that had gotten the reaction that Posh Pig got. And people were in the comments. I started reading them and it was like, how do I buy this? How do I buy a print of this? Yada, yada, yada. And I was like, a print, but it's a painting. And I'd be writing back going, no, it's a painting. And they'd be like, yeah, but how do I get a print of it? And I'd be like, what do you mean? And I was so naive to the whole world of fine art that I remember in LA, I was like to Jack, people are wanting a print of this. How do I? So I rang. Oh my God, this is so funny when I think about it now. I rang from LA. I rang Reed's, you know, Reed's of Nassau Street.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah.
I was like, I remember when I was in college, I used to get things printed for like projects and stuff.
For 50 cents.
Yeah. And like they'd have colour on them.
Yeah.
So I rang Reed's of Nassau Street and I was like, hi there, I painted a Posh Pig. And I'm just wondering, some people want to get a print of it. How would I go about printing it? And they were like, you painted, it's a painting. And I was like, yeah. So can I print it, a print of it? And they were like, no, you're good. This is not the right place for you. And then they put me on to somebody else and I was like, oh, okay. So I rang them and they were like, we can do that. We can scan for you, but what you're looking for is detailed scanned print. And I was like, okay. And then I think it was like through so many people, I got to the Copper House and I rang Mark in the Copper House. And he to this day still talks about that first phone call and how I wrecked his head. I asked him about 25 questions. He's not a talker and he'll say that himself and we joke now because he's like, oh my God, if I remember just picking up that phone call. And I was like, hi, my name's Audrey, I've painted a few pieces and people want prints of them, how do I do it, what do I do? Anyway, I schooled myself on it through a lot of questions and answers from Mark in the Copper House, which we are very tight now. And then that's it. I started sending them. I think I sent them to him from LA, the first few. And then I came home and I went to the Copper House to meet him and looked at what was done. And I was like, oh my God, you know what it's like. If you've painted through him, it's like your painting is transformed into a print, but it looks like your painting. It's like 3D. And I paint with a lot of raised and textured and layers. So I was like, there's no way you're going to be able to, but obviously you see from your work and my work that it looks like. So it's the cruise scanner that he has in there. Do you know it's the only one in Ireland?
He said it to me.
It's like
all the
his
time.
Little golden child.
Yeah, it is. It's like a child of his. And I know he has children. I think that's he prefers the scanner
more
over
important.
His kids. Exactly.
Sorry, Mark.
And then obviously it just shows that creativity can be channeled through so many different mediums. And then Audrey Apparel came and you know, every Marvel superhero has an origin story, and you've just described your origin story there
like
so
that.
Beautifully, you know, and you're still a Marvel hero.
I will take that. Absolutely.
Yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You.
Yeah. No, so thank you. It's a brilliant segue into what you have achieved in a relatively very short period of time.
Thanks.
But of course, the Baby Tribe is a parenting podcast.
Yes.
And I want to talk to you about your journey into motherhood. Can you share to us how you became, or sorry, not how you became a mother.
There's this thing called...
That's not for this podcast, maybe for another podcast. It's funny, we were just joking about how we need to stay kosher on podcasts like
this.
Yeah.
I was like, we need to use the right terminology because there's been a lot of wrong terminology out there.
Let me rephrase that, sorry. Can you share with us how becoming a mother has influenced your perspective? Because obviously... you've been very transparent about your motherhood journey, and there's a couple of aspects of it that I really want to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. But first and foremost is you really celebrated the birth of Bo, and you really kind of shared the story of her birth and her growth on your Instagram page. So how has that changed you, or has it changed you in any way?
Bo is the best thing that has ever happened to us. Oh, I'm probably going to get emotional now, which is weird. She is just... I was 35 when I got pregnant with Beau. I'm now 37. So I was considered a geriatric pregnancy, which not many people know that
the term is AMA, Advanced Maternal Age.
Yeah, you'd know the right. Geriatric is what I hear when you hear geriatric pregnancy. I remember... I knew we were a little bit late in the game in the female side, not so much Jack, because you can have kids up until the age of whatever, right?
Yeah.
Is there a cutoff point?
No, I don't think
no. Great. Another thing that you guys just don't have to deal with. But I remember, you know, there was a pressure of getting going on having a baby. We want more children. We wanted children. Always been something that we've talked about, so it was never like how are we going to have a conversation about it? It was just known. But the one thing that we did want to focus on, and I'll talk for myself here, is I wanted a career. I've always worked since the age of 18. I need to work. I need to be in a field of doing something creative. So I knew I needed to set something up for myself and for my mental health before thinking about having a child. So we did that. So we were trying, there was no mad story on for how long or whatever. And then I became pregnant. So we were absolutely over the moon. Funny story. I arrived to the studio one day and I opened the door and I was like, "I've got a surprise for you, Bob." And he was like, "Oh," and I walked in and I just put the pregnancy test on the table and he goes, "Oh no." And I went, "What?" And he was like, "You've COVID." And I was like, "No." I was like, "Jack."
I've never heard that one before.
He was
amazing.
Like, "Oh." And then he just burst out crying. He was like, "Oh my God." Because it was one of the ones that almost
the two lines.
Looked.
Yeah.
He was like, "Oh shit. No, what?" So that was funny. But anyway, we have a little picture up in the studio of the very first scan that sits there. And we're like, so I still look at it going, "Oh my God, I can't believe that was her." But she's the best thing ever. It's influenced me to just try to be the best mum for her and for myself as possible. She's a little ray of sunshine. I don't know where she got her personality from, but she has some personality. And she inspires my work. She inspires me every day. She's amazing. She's the best thing.
And on that, in terms of your work, you were back in the studio pretty much very quickly. And because when you're running your own business, there's no such thing as maternity leave. And I mean, I've been following you for a while and it struck me at how quickly you went back.
Yeah.
And I remember you posting a picture of yourself painting with one hand and holding her with another
feeding
hand.
Feeding her. She was in that photo. I'm pretty sure I was breastfeeding her and signing
her painting.
Same time.
Exactly. Yeah. You were back to work. And did you find that challenging? And how did you manage to balance being a mum with continuing your career?
I think that I made the decision to go back to work for myself. So there was no pressure on me to go back to work. But I think it was 4 weeks that I gave myself off at home, just bonding, me and Beau. But I became very, not insular, but like I just became very...
isolated.
Isolated, exactly. I didn't have, you know, the way usually there'd be girls the same age and their friends would be having babies. My friends had had babies maybe the year or year, 2 years before. So I was kind of on my own in that area. And I was like, I'm not a daytime TV watcher. I'm not like, you know, I can go off to Dundrum. It's only so many times you can go off and walk around a shopping centre on your own. All my friends work. My sister works. So she has her kids. And I was like, I miss going to work for my own mental health. So I was like, I want to go in, but I don't want to force myself to work. So I almost went in for the first few months to feel like I had a little bit of a routine. I brought Beau with me. We work for ourselves. So it was her mom and dad and her.
And just for clarification, your studio is in a different
space.
Yes. It's not where you live.
No, it's not where we live. So I have two spaces. I have the art studio and then we've got the studio where we package.
Yes.
We have the packaging and then we've got a couple of people that work
with us.
So
you literally did bring her to work.
I brought her to work. Yeah. She came with me to work. But it was all set up in the studio. You know, we had her little rocker and her toys and it was like she was at home. It was just me and her and then Jack and the others are in the other space. So yeah, it wasn't when people say to me, God, aren't you great going back to work? I'm like, no, I need to stress this because I do not want women to feel in any way like they need to be going back to work because you don't. I work for myself. I created my own hours. It's not extensive what I was doing. I wasn't going busting my ass doing anything crazy. I was sitting in a chair and I was very aware that I was only doing things that I wanted to do. And then, yeah, and I wanted to start painting. So I did bring the painting studio home because I didn't want Beau to be in like an area of like a lot of paint and all that.
Yeah.
So is that the one you're talking about of me carrying?
I think so,
her?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. That's a different picture I was talking about. Yeah. So I did. I painted Colorful Chaos with her pretty much in my arms the whole time. But
And so it's a great segue into what I want to ask you next. And it's sort of a multifaceted question. So bear with me.
Okay.
There's been a recent article in the Irish Times that has pitched breastfeeding as something that was almost limiting to women rather than something that, you know, women can continue living their life and doing at the same time. And there was a challenge in the article to the universal recommendation that babies should be breastfeeding for the first 6 months exclusively and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of debate about this article. The reason I'm bringing it up is that I think you are an amazing example and an inspiration demonstrating that you can maintain living your life under your terms and continuing to breastfeed as well. There's an amazing picture of you, and I think it's with your friend Georgie Crawford.
Yes.
Looking very glam on a night out and you were pumping. And I think it's a great example demonstrating that you can still do the things that you want to do and maintain a breastfeeding relationship with your child.
Totally.
So do you think, and I know you've commented before that you've sometimes have gotten some, I suppose, pushback when you have shown breastfeeding imagery of yourself, of people feeling maybe awkward or disenfranchised. So what do you say to that? We'll start with, did you feel that it impeded your life?
No. So my sister she's the best person. She's my best friend. She is my older sister and she has two girls. And she breastfed her two girls. I think in total, my sister was breastfeeding for 6 years. So she did nearly 3 years, I think, on both. And I remember thinking, oh my God, how are you doing that? Like that's insane and incredible at the same time. And I was like, I'm like, there's no way I'd be able to breastfeed for that long. I just never thought of it as something. I never thought of it as anything in terms of, I was like, oh, I'll do the 6 months that's recommended. And that's that. And then obviously having Beau, luckily she latched on straight away. I didn't have much problems with the nipple situation. A cracked nipple here and there. I put the cream on it, yada, yada. But there was no, I didn't have a negative start with her feeding. So for me, the beginning of breastfeeding was actually quite enjoyable, which is not the usual, let's say, because it is a very difficult process for many, many women. So when I don't use the word easy a lot, especially on social media, but it was an easy enough journey for myself and Beau. So I've just kept going. And when I say it's been easy enough for and easy for us, is that it hasn't impacted a change in the way that we live our lives. I go out, I have a couple of glasses of wine if I want to. There's a big stigma against that. I ask my sister so many questions. She's a breastfeeding counsellor as well. I always get this wrong and she goes mad. I always say, so my sister's a breastfeeding consultant. And she's like, Audrey, I am absolutely not a breastfeeding consultant. I'm a breastfeeding counsellor. Big difference. And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. And I'm like, my sister's a breastfeeding consultant. And she's like, oh my God, stop telling people that. She's a counsellor. And she's obviously very experienced herself. So, yes, I can have a couple of glasses of wine if I want to. I can go out with my friends if I want to. I can leave Beau at home with her dad for hours on end if I want to. All the things that I would be doing if she was bottle fed, I can be doing.
And that's an amazing thing that you bring up, because what the article said is that if you are breastfeeding, it automatically distances your partner away from you, that your partner cannot have a role then in helping you and supporting you. And this is a prime example of it not actually being true.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
The only thing Jack hasn't done much with parenting Beau is feeding her.
He's done everything else.
He is the most hands-on dad.
Yeah.
He is involved with every aspect of her life.
Yeah.
The only thing he's not as involved in is when it comes to milk and her mouth.
Yeah.
Feeding her, cooking for her, all of that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's not missing out on anything. She's getting a bit of nutrition from my boob. She's not getting something from her dad that she could be. Whereas I know it's a great bonding experience for some men where they get to feed through a bottle, and that's amazing. And there's no fault in either or. It's like anything. There's always going to be one person that says this or that, but there's never the right way for anything for anyone. There's always going to be someone. So I'm doing what I'm doing because it works for me and Beau. I'm continuing to breastfeed her because she still wants it, and I'm not going to take it away from her. She's still getting nutrients, and why would I stop it? If it gets to a point where I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore, it's annoying, or I don't want to do this anymore, it's too much,
or it's stopping me
from things that I really want to do, then maybe I'll reconsider, okay, let's pull back a little bit.
So again, a great example of how you're in control, you know?
100%.
In a good way.
Yeah, in a good way.
Yeah.
But I'm also in the mind frame where she is my everything. So I'm my stance on it, and I'm only speaking from myself, and it's my experience, is that I want to give her everything that she wants right now. And there is no such thing as spoiling a baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
Point blank. That's it, in my opinion. So I cannot spoil her by giving her milk.
Brilliant.
So that's it.
Brilliant answer. I know we're running out of time, and I want to touch
already?
On... I know we're running out of time, so I want to touch on your art. But I want to do... I mean, your art is amazing. It's fabulous. You have been one of my inspirations to actually start.
You're amazing. If anybody hasn't checked out Afif's art, go on to his Instagram and check it out. He does amazing breastfeeding pictures as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What I wanted to get at is, I mean, your art speaks for itself, but I wanted to touch on the angle. You've used your art for advocacy in a couple of ways.
Yes.
You've done, I don't want to get the name of it wrong, FEM.
FEM.
In promoting
Breast Cancer Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And I also note that a lot of schools use your art as project for their kids to foster art. So
yes.
Did that something that you were purposefully trying to get into, or did it just happen by chance?
It just happened by chance. It's on the website as the AHA Give Back. So it's my way of finding my way through my art to get money for a specific charity. So it actually started before the year of COVID, the Australian bushfires. And I remember sitting at home and everyone was like sending and looking at pictures of these animals that were being burnt. And it was the most horrific scenes, nothing compared to what we're seeing now. But at that time, it was horrific for people to see these animals being burnt. And I remember thinking, oh, like, what could I do? And then I was like, okay, it's in the bushfire. It's in the outback in Australia. You know, I've never painted an Australian animal. Will I paint a koala? And let's see if I could get a bit of money for WWF Australia. So I painted a koala called Coco, and that's where it began. And that sold out, and I raised 32,500 Australian dollars. So it was just over 20,000 euro. And the embassy, Australian embassy, got on and they were like, oh my God, this is amazing. Thank you so much. Nobody's ever done this. Something like this, like painting something for us. So I was like, oh, this is actually something, first of all, I enjoyed, because my art was doing something other than making, you know, a customer happy. It was actually making a little bit of a difference. So obviously my friend Georgie, she was diagnosed in 2017 with breast cancer, and she is an advocate for an ambassador for Breast Cancer Ireland. And I remember at that time, Georgie had kind of been mentioning that they, Breast Cancer Ireland, obviously weren't getting the funds that they usually would with their runs and the outdoor or indoor things that they'd be doing to raise money.
There was
money.
A big drop in,
yeah. in charities. Yeah. And so that's when I painted Femme. So I was like, I'm going to paint a big pair of boobs and see what happens after the painting Coco. Let's try and do this for Breast Cancer Ireland. And we raised 21,000 euro for them as well.
That's amazing. And people, there's still prints there left?
No, there's none of Femme left. But then the next year, so I was like, okay, I'm going to do something every year and we're going to do it. And it's going to be the AHA give back. And I'm going to, so the next year I did, because the amount of people that missed out on Femme were like, please paint another pair of boobs.
Yes.
So I did. And I painted Peaches, which were the purple ones. And we raised 18,000 for them.
Amazing.
And then there was the last one. Last year's give back was for Crumlin Children's Hospital. I had a little stint with Bo the first few months of her. It was a little breathing thing that I think me and Jack freaked out more than anything. But we went to Crumlin and they were unbelievable. But it was more the children that we saw in there when we were in there. Bo was fine, thank God. But it was quite heartbreaking, the scenes that you see when you're in there. And the nurses are absolute angel people. So I wanted to paint something for the children in Crumlin Children's Hospital and to go towards their needs. So I painted Bunny and we raised, I think it was 12,500 for them. We're a small little business, but it makes you feel like there you can do anything to make a, to raise a little bit of money for a charity.
I think, yeah, one thing unique about using art for advocacy in that I think it's a lot more universal because everybody can understand that language and it resonates with people regardless of their background, their language.
Exactly.
And I think it's an amazing way of doing it. And, you know, yours is a case in point that they were able to do it in Australia and here as well. And for various different causes based on, you know, what you feel is appropriate at the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's amazing. Finally, and I'd love to be able to chat to you a lot longer. But
that's gone so quick.
I know. But finally, what advice would you give our listeners who are parents about nurturing creativity in their children?
Great question. One thing I have always said since the very beginning of my art business journey is art class is just as important as maths class. When I grew up in school, it wasn't seen as important as. It was all about science, maths, Irish, English, history, geography. And the creatives were pushed to almost the extracurricular activities. Now, art obviously is within the curriculum of the Leaving Cert and the Junior Cert, but it's not really taken as a serious subject. I remember people would like take art as a subject just to have it on, to add on a few points in their exams. Whereas I'm a right-brained person. There's a bit of a left there with business, but I'm a right-brained creative. And growing up is the exact time where that should be promoted within a little child or a person, not demoted and like pushed to the side and forcing them to use their left brain and forcing them into curriculum that they've absolutely no interest in. I would advise any parent, if you are seeing a hint of a sparkle of creativity in your children, and if it's something that they are showing interest in, to push on that and let them express themselves. There's so many different ways of expressing creativity. It should be in the school system more than it is, and it should be taken seriously because, as you can see, it can actually make a difference.
Absolutely. What a way to end the conversation. Audrey, thank you so much for coming on the Baby Tribe.
I loved it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We're delighted to have shared this time with you, offering guidance and support for your parenting journey.
I've been Afif and she's been Katie, and together we've been your guides in exploring the multifaceted world of parenting. Remember, every step you take in nurturing your child makes a world of difference.
Stay connected with us and don't miss our next episode, where we'll continue to delve into the valuable insights and practical tips for raising healthy and happy children. Thank you for being part of our tribe, and remember, you're doing an amazing job.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.